uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations all across the United States, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite system, streaming around the planet on the internet, and in cable systems in 29 states on CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. On this beautiful Wednesday, the 15th of June, it's the Ides of June. The old Ides of March, I actually wrote a poem about that when I was in high school, in Latin class. Et tu, Brute? Probably a little too arcane for most folks, but anyhow, for Latin junkies, you say Ides, they think March, and you think about Julius Caesar. Anyhow, the FBI, this from the Swift Report. Thought you'd want to know. Important stuff. According to the results of an extensive FBI wiretap, Americans overwhelmingly support the Patriot Act and think the FBI should have even more power to listen in on their conversations, read their mail, and follow their online interactions. The FBI plans to release the results of the wiretap conducted on 1,200 Americans to boost its campaign for expansion of the Patriot Act. In conversations with friends, loved ones, 90% of Americans say they think the FBI deserves more power, according to the FBI. That from the Swift Report blogs.com. Yes, it's tongue-in-cheek, of course. This not tongue-in-cheek. The question, by the way, for the hour that we're going to get to in just a minute is, are the Republicans taking us back to a time where it was illegal for, not just impractical, but illegal for middle-class folks, working people, to buy silk and jewelry? Could it be possible? Well, you know, the specter is raised in today's Wall Street Journal. We'll get to that in just a minute. But first, there is a country that is a hotbed. In fact, some would say the worldwide source of the most virulent, toxic, anti-American, anti-Western, anti-all other religions form of fundamentalist Islam. A country which is now defying the United States, the European Union, and Australia by resisting, I'm reading here from the Associated Press, but an article by George John, by resisting UN efforts to verify that it has no nuclear assets worth inspecting, according to a confidential EU document obtained Tuesday by the Associated Press. Their resistance to inspections adds another worry for a top-level meeting of the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, this week. This government insists it has no interest in obtaining nuclear weapons, but in the past two decades, it has been linked to pre-war Iraq's nuclear program. This country has been linked to AQ Khan, the Pakistani nuclear black marketeer, the guy who was out there selling nuclear technology secrets to, for example, North Korea. In Iran, A.Q. Khan, he's still walking around loose. This country has also expressed interest in Pakistani missiles capable of carrying nuclear warheads. And officials from this country have reportedly discussed pursuing the nuclear option as a deterrent, presumably to Israel's nuclear capability in the volatile Middle East. This country also is the country of origin, the country of citizenship, of 15 of the 19 people who slammed airplanes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and a field over Pennsylvania. And this country also has been responsible for transferring over $1 billion, that's one with a B, that's one followed by what, nine zeros? $1 billion. No, it's one with 12 zeros, isn't it? Anyhow, with all those zeros after it, $1,000 million to the Bush family and its business interests over the past 35 years. The country? Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is defying the UN right now and saying that they will not let nuclear inspectors into their country. Now, I mean, what more does it take? What more does it take? You've got a country that has bought off senior officials within a government, within our government, some would say. I mean, you know, Bush Sr. was having breakfast with a member of the bin Laden family, one of Osama's half-brothers, at the time of 9/11, at the moment of 9/11. You've got a country that has bought off senior administration officials, that has been involved in a lot of this nefarious nuclear stuff, that is the source of Wahhabism around the world, that supplied 15 of the 19 hijackers, that supplied the guy who a Saudi citizen, Osama bin Laden, came up with the idea, apparently, of 9/11. And what are we going to do about this? Well, you know, they're still giving a lot of money to the Bush family and their friends. I mean, L. Paul Bremer now, on the board of the Carlyle Group. A little more Saudi money there. So, don't expect any quick action from our government. But just, can you imagine how the Republicans would spin this if Bill Clinton had taken $1 billion from the Saudis, Bill Clinton and his family, over the past 35 years? Can you imagine how this would be spun? How the right-wingers, it would be beyond imagination. I raise it. I think it's important. It's interesting. Important for us to know about. Keep an eye on. Frankly, my concern is not so much with the Saudi past. The Saudi past, clearly, you know, in the deal that the House of Saud made with Mr. Waha, the founder of Wahhabism, back in the 1940s, 1950s, you know, we'll let you grow your fundamentalist religious sect in our country, and we will merge church and state, the Saudis said to the Wahhabists. And in exchange for that, you'll help us retain political power by telling everybody in your mosques, in your churches, what we would call churches, or the Christian analogy would be churches, you tell everybody in your houses of worship that they should vote for us. And we'll give you money, we'll give you support, we'll keep you in power. Keep in mind, last year the Bush administration gave $1 billion in faith-based initiatives. $1 billion to churches. And I just, the parallels here creep me out. I'm sorry. I think this is a bad thing. It was a bad thing for Saudi Arabia. It brought us Osama bin Laden. It brought us Wahhabism. It brought us the rise of radical Islam, which is not good for Islam any more than it is good for the world. And I see the rise of radical Christianity now in the United States as being, you know, as dangerous and as toxic to the United States as the rise of radical Islam was to, you know, is to Saudi Arabia and to, you know, the whole thing over there. I mean, this is we have our own guys here in this country. I mean, we have our own Wahhabists in this country.
That I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who tried to secularize America, I point the thing in their face and say, you helped this happen.
That Jerry Falwell.
I totally concur. And the problem is we've adopted that agenda at the highest levels of our government, and so we're responsible as a free society for what the top people do. And the top people, of course, the court system.
That Pat Robertson, from 2001, from 9/13, 2 days after 9/11, 2001, Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson discussing how we deserved this. I mean, what's the difference between these guys and the Wahhabists?
What we saw on Tuesday, as terrible as it is, could be minuscule if in fact God continues to lift the curtain and allow the enemies of America to give us probably what we deserve.
Well, Jerry, that's my feeling. I think we've just seen the antechamber to terror. We haven't even begun to see what they can do to the major population.
Yeah, we deserved it. Right? Straight from the mouth of Jerry Falwell. And you know, and he's agreeing with the Wahhabists. You know, they thought we deserved it too. And when Falwell goes into his thing about they're trying to create a secular state in America, excuse me, the word secular means having to do with the civics, having to do with civics, having to do with the business of the people. We are a secular state. It doesn't mean that there's no place for religion. They're trying to reinvent the word. You can be very religious and still participate in a secular state by voting, by paying your taxes, by using the public roads, by going to public schools. Secular does not mean anti-religious. A functioning secular state has plenty of room for religion. It's simply not controlled by religion. So the Saudis made a deal with the devil, and look at what it brought us. It brought us to the brink of world war. And now the Bushies are making a deal with the devil, in my opinion. And I'm not sure I even mean that metaphorically. I mean, anybody who would say on national television that we deserved 9/11 and that human beings, specifically gays, in the case of Falwell, are the reason why God would want to allow this thing to happen to us. It is in my mind such a perversion of the religion that I was raised in that I have to just turn my back on those people and say, I'm sorry. This is not Christian. These men are not Christians, and that is not Christianity. Speaking as a Christian and speaking as an American, that is not Americanism. That is not patriotism. That is spitting on this country. So, and enough of that rant. I want to get back to the rich are very rich in America these days, writes Cynthia Crossan in today's Wall Street Journal. And even the merely affluent can afford silk underwear and diamond dog collars. In earlier eras, she writes, the reaction to such conspicuous consumption that, on the part of the middle class, might have been sumptuary laws. Is this a new one for you? Sumptuary laws. We'll get to that right after this. 20 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. The end is coming soon. I hope not. I think that we can make something good out of this. I really do. I am an optimist. I really and truly am. And why? Because there's no alternative. If you look back in history, the people historically who have made positive things happen have always been the people who believed it was possible. That's the first step. You have to believe that it's possible to make something good happen before you can start to make something good happen. And if we're going to take this country back, we have to believe it's possible. And I still believe it's possible. In fact, I'm seeing more and more evidence of it every single day. Every single day. Moondog in our chat room, who also lives here in Portland, commenting, last night we had a tsunami. We had a tsunami. It was only a 2-inch tsunami, but we had a tsunami. And the tsunami alert, and I was in bed asleep. It was 8 o'clock, 8:30. I was not yet asleep, but I was in bed. Louise and I were in bed. And one of our kids comes running in going, They just had an earthquake off the ocean, and it's there's a tsunami warning. And so, you know, we flip on the TV to the Pacific News Network. You know, there's this kind of Washington State and Oregon news, cable news system network thing. And sure enough, you know, they're doing their tsunami warning, and the horns are going off all up and down the coast, and people are heading for high water because there was this 7-point-something-or-other earthquake just off the coast of Eureka, California, but I guess 80, 90 miles off the coast. And we live, which I've probably mentioned, we live in a house that is floating in a river and on some pontoons. It's, you know, it doesn't have a motor or anything like that. It's not like a houseboat. They call it a floating home. And so anyhow, we're living in a river that's connected to the Pacific Ocean. And our daughter comes in and goes, "Oh, no, here it comes. You know, we're doomed. Or are we?" You know, and I said, no, I think we're about 100 miles from the ocean. I don't think the tsunami is going to make it this far. But it was interesting. So anyhow, Moondog in the chat room says, well, if Jerry Falwell says that 9/11 was God's, you know, God getting us because we allow gays in America, and you know, Falwell and Robertson, both of them agreeing on that point, then you know, could it be that the tsunami that we had, the earthquake and the tsunami that we had yesterday, was, you know, God trying to tell us he doesn't like Arnold trying to usurp the political process on the West Coast, in California mostly, much of the West Coast, with his special election, his multi-million-dollar special election coming up in November to try and, you know, do this giant power grab of, you know, cutting the knees out from underneath the public service employees unions and the nurses and things like that. Could it be? It's an interesting speculation. I think rather unlikely, but you know, see, because I don't think that 9/11 was God's punishment for anything either. You know, I'm just, that's not, I don't go there with that. That's not part of my religious worldview. Anyhow, the rich are very rich in America these days, and even the merely affluent can afford silk underwear and diamond dog collars, writes Cynthia Crossan. In earlier eras, the reaction to such conspicuous consumption would have been sumptuary laws. These, she writes, were enacted throughout Europe and Asia from ancient times through the 18th century, and they prohibited common people from wearing flashy status symbols, jewels, silk, or pointy-toed shoes, for example, and from spending too much on other extravagances such as parties. And she goes back to ancient Rome, for example. You couldn't spend more than 100 asses, that's, you know, animals were a common currency, to celebrate certain festivals. On non-festival days, Roman citizens could only spend 10 donkeys on a party and serve no more than one hen, no more than one, and that one not fattened for the purpose. And she goes on to say, sumptuary laws had some laudable purposes, some good purposes. They did some good things. They discouraged farmers and laborers from throwing away their rent money on baubles, and they promoted, or tried to anyway, promote selflessness. Is it time to bring back the sumptuary laws so that the middle class in America will stop trying to be comfortable? It's the question of the day for the conservatives. 29 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman. It's a beautiful day. Skyfall, you feel like it's a beautiful day.
And welcome back to the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations, my friends. Tom Hartman here helping you win the water cooler wars. Why sumptuary laws, despite a rich history, never lasted very long. Actually, they lasted thousands of years. And interesting to see this in the Wall Street Journal. They're not actually asking the question, should we bring them back? They're just kind of tossing it out there. For example, again, quoting from this article, quite well written by Cynthia Crossan. The column is titled Deja Vu, by the way. She says the ruling class didn't want to risk guessing another man's status, an inevitable result if everyone could wear leopard fur or taffeta jerkins. Before the laws were adopted in 14th century England, wrote Henry Knighton in his Chronicles of the period, quote, there was so much pride amongst the common people in vying with one another in dress and ornaments that it was scarce possible to distinguish the poor from the rich, the servant from the master, or a priest from other men. Now, back then, of course, the priests were exempted from the sumptuary laws. So if you were the royalty, if you were the royal family, if you were the wealthy lords, or if you were priests, then you could conspicuously consume. But if you were a common laborer, no. There were laws against it. Even if you had the money, there were laws against it. One of the reasons, you know, one of the reasons that the kings and nobles would pass such laws was that they wanted to make sure that folks were not spending everything they had so that there was something left over that they could take, you know, in taxation. This, back when taxes were defined not by we the people or representatives of the we the people, but by warlords or theocrats or rich nobles, the sort of thing that led to the French Revolution. Elizabeth I, who became England's queen in 1558, and in 1560, as I recall, I could be wrong on the... I thought it was 1600. The year 16, in December of 1600, or maybe even 1601, Queen Elizabeth I signed the Articles of Incorporation for the British East India Company, brought that into being. She strongly advocated sumptuary laws, notes Crossan in the Wall Street Journal. The desire for such, she said, that without them you would have social confusion, and the result would be the meanest were as richly apparelled as their betters. Huh, how dare they? The desire for such clothes could so overwhelm such inferior persons, said Queen Elizabeth I, that they might be driven to robbing and stealing by the highway. So outraged was Elizabeth by the monstrous and outrageous competition for most extravagant hose that she set a precise limit, a little more than a yard, on how much textile could be used for a pair of men's stockings. And then she points out that George Mason, one of the drafters of the Constitution, said we should have sumptuary laws in the United States. Didn't fly all that well. In fact, Eldridge Gerry of Massachusetts said the law of necessity is the best sumptuary law. Yeah. John Wesley, all in favor of it. But, you know, are we reaching a point? Here's the bottom line. Are we reaching a point in the United States where the middle class, at some level, that the ruling classes could make the case for sumptuary laws by pointing out things like the debt crisis in the United States, where the average middle-class wage earner in the United States is $7,000 in debt to credit card companies and owns less than, I forget the most recent number, my recollection is it's somewhere between 5 and 7% of the total equity in their home on average, that we're mortgaged up to our eyeballs, and that this could be a disaster waiting to happen. You know, could it be? Could that be? And therefore, should the government, the conservatives would say, should the government step in and tighten the screws? Well, I'm saying they already have. This is what the bankruptcy bill was all about. Make it harder for people to back away from those kinds of debts. So it's kind of the backside sumptuary laws. It's kind of sort of after the fact. We don't care any longer if people look like they're wealthy, because it's not like we have to have, you know, the so rigid social class like they did back in England in the 18th century. But we also increasingly in the United States want to make sure, it seems, at least the ruling classes of the United States, the plutocrats, the aristocrats, the millionaires in the Senate and the Republican Party in particular, and among the Democratic conservatives as well, want to make sure that social mobility is reduced or inhibited, that the class into which people are born is the class in which they stay. And in fact, the desire for people to better themselves which was once seen as a good thing in the United States, is now seen as a danger. The Bush administration, for example, and Republican leaders in Congress are scrambling, this from also from the Wall Street Journal today, are scrambling to beef up legislation regulating mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Now, these are the groups that back up mortgages to the tune of $1.5 trillion in the United States. They finance about half of all U.S. home mortgages. And the Wall Street Journal notes both the White House and Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan argue that the two companies, which are involved in financing nearly half of U.S. home mortgages, have gotten too big, mainly by borrowing at lower interest rates than other companies. And the reason why, because people are willing to invest in them. People are willing to invest in them because people mistakenly believe that Freddie Mae and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's debt is backed up by the U.S. Treasury. In fact, it's not. But people think it's a good investment. And so the Wall Street Journal notes, the concern is that they pose a broader risk to financial markets if they fail to hedge their portfolios properly. Fannie and Freddie originally were chartered as agencies by Congress to help boost home ownership, but they have since evolved into publicly traded companies. In fact, the CEO of Freddie Mac made, $8 or $9 million last year. I mean, they're into the realm of kingdoms, of corporate kingdoms now. And they're sitting on $1.5 trillion worth of debt. And there's folks who are a little concerned about this. The Wall Street Journal notes, still, the House committee's refusal to accept the administration's terms illustrates that the two companies retain plenty of strong allies in Congress despite their accounting scandals. So here we see Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae are also fielding lobbyists, and they're passing out big bucks in Congress. And so Congress is not going along with the White House and Greenspan. And this is, you know, one of those rare instances where I actually agree with the White House and with Alan Greenspan and saying, you know, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae may have slipped into you know, a danger area here. But, you know, frankly, the reason why is because Alan Greenspan drove interest rates down so low before the 2004 election in order to try and goose the economy up so that George W. Bush would get reelected. I mean, it's really quite simple. The Journal goes on, in the current debate, the two seem to be benefiting from politicians' fear of taking steps that might be seen as hurting the housing market at a time when there is increased concern about a housing price bubble. See, there it is. There it is. People are sitting on all this debt, and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are sitting on all this debt, $1.5 trillion of it. And if the market goes south, then what happens is housing prices start going negative. And when housing prices start going negative, somebody borrows, you know, $200,000 for a house that's worth $200,000. And a lot of people are doing this now. They're buying houses with no money down or 1 or 2 or 3% down, you know, a negligible amount down, all things considered. And this is being encouraged in the mortgage markets, and I think it's, frankly, a very dangerous thing to do. And you know, there are times in the cycle when it actually might be a good idea, but this is not the time in the cycle, frankly, in my opinion. But anyhow, people do this, and then the bubble bursts. Debt becomes more expensive. That's what will burst the bubble. The cost of interest goes up. Greenspan starts cranking up interest rates. Other countries start saying that they're not interested in buying our treasury bills anymore. The government is competing with people who want to, if you want to borrow money to buy your house, you're competing with George W. Bush right now for that money, because he's got to borrow $2 billion a day. He has to borrow in the name of our children and grandchildren in order to maintain his tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. No, very seriously. Had there been no Bush tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires, we would not have to borrow $2 billion a day. Now, we may have to borrow a little bit because of the $300 billion that's been spent on the war in Iraq, or that's been allocated for it. About $179 billion of it has been spent so far, and about $9 billion of it is missing. And where are the old line conservatives saying $9 billion missing? Where'd the money go? Nobody's asking the question. Although Paul Bremer's living pretty large these days. not to suggest that he might have anything to do with missing money. But it's a question I'd like to see answered. But in any case, so the bubble bursts because the interest rates go up because demand for borrowed money increases, right? And so as Bush is having to borrow more and more money to finance his tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires and borrowing it in the name of our children and grandchildren, he's borrowing it principally from foreign countries. About half of the U.S. debt is being financed by foreign countries buying our debt. And at some point, those countries may say, you know, we're just not going to do this anymore. In fact, China has already started cutting back. Japan has already started cutting back, and South Korea has talked about cutting back on the total amount of debt that they're buying from the United States. And the reason why, of course, is because the dollar had been depreciating, so they were buying debt, and then, you know, it would be paid back with dollars that were worth less, or actually, you know, with the yuan that cost more, well, the yuan's tied to the dollar, with the yen that cost more, or with South Korean, whatever their currency is, I'm forgetting, that it costs more. So interest rates go up, and as a result of interest rates going up, the price of houses go down because people don't buy houses based on saying hey, okay, it would cost $190,000, it costs $150,000 to build this house in terms of raw materials, and the land it's sitting on is worth $50,000, therefore the house is worth $200,000. That's not how houses, I mean, in theory that's how houses are priced, but the reality is that, you know, there's something else going on here, and that is that a good chunk of housing prices has to do with what the monthly payments are. And so, you know, if at $1,000 a month you can make a payment on a $200,000 mortgage that's mostly interest, that, you know, it's got a balloon on the end of it or whatever, then, you know, people who have who can spend $1,000 a month on housing can buy $200,000 houses. Well, if interest rates go up from 4%, you know, right now more or less up to say 6%, that's a 50% increase. That $1,000 a month might become $1,100 a month or $1,200 a month in payments that you have to make. Or even $1,300 or $1,400 a month in payments that you have to make. And at that point, those people can't afford that $200,000 house anymore. They can only afford a $160,000 house. And so what happens? People start selling the houses, or people start walking away from the mortgages, saying, hey, the house is now worth less than what I owe on it. Why should I keep paying? And they walk away. And you see foreclosures increase. And we're seeing that right now all across the United States. Foreclosures are increasing significantly. Several articles in the Wall Street Journal just in the last month or two about the increase in the rate of foreclosures really got a lot of people nervous. And Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae are sitting on $1.5 trillion of this debt. And if this bubble bursts, it's going to be, I mean, this could make 1929 look like a picnic. Because Bush has run us into the ditch. With trickle-down economics, you know, from Reagan till now, I mean, when Reagan came into office, America was wealthy. The 25% of Americans were members of unions and had jobs, which meant that 50% of Americans had jobs where you could put your kids through school, put your kids through college, your medical expenses were covered, you had a pension, you had retirement, you had job security, because for every union job, there's usually one equal job in the local marketplace, you know, because the union set the floor for the cost of labor. When Ronald Reagan came into office, half of America could do that. At the peak of unionization and of the American middle class, the growth of the American middle class, 1947, 35% of Americans were union members, 70% of Americans, of American families, a single wage earner could raise a family. Now even two wage earners can't do what a single wage earner could do in 1980, the year that Ronald Reagan came into office and began moving us in the direction of, you know, away from, began undoing the New Deal, moving us away from demand-side economics, the classical economics that have, you know, ruled for centuries, and moving us towards so-called trickle-down economics or conservative economics or supply-side economics or whatever you want to call it, voodoo economics, what George Bush Sr. called it, and thus setting us up for a disaster. We're now down to about 8.5% to 9% of the private workforce in America is unionized. And the Bush administration wants to do away with a good chunk of that. And this is what Schwarzenegger in California is all about, is busting up unions. He's trying to do it by referendum. I'm telling you, the unions are the last thing. It's all about power. They're the last thing that stands between the American middle class and poverty. And being in the position of Bob Cratchit in A Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens' story about, you know, remember Scrooge, remember Bob Cratchit, his employee, who, you know, please, Mr. Scrooge, may I have a lump of coal for war? You know, and my son, he's going to die if he can't see a doctor.
Ha! Huh, says Scrooge. Not my problem. You're poor.
Right? That's the world that the conservatives want to take us back to, because that was the, you know, that was the heyday of conservative economics. It was called feudalism. Well, it wasn't called that then, but Victorian economics. 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
So, hey, there's a new American way. No one's serving those deserving, but there's less tax to pay. We abuse our might and mock the world as we say. Don't mess with the U.S. of A.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Tomorrow, John Conyers, just a reminder, he's going to be holding major hearings on the Downing Street Minutes. If you haven't heard about it on your local television station, your local radio station, if you didn't read about it in your local newspaper, call them now and ask them, why have I not heard about John Conyers? And why have I not heard about the fact that there are hearings going on in Washington, D.C. into what may be an impeachable offense by the President of the United States that led to the death of over 1,600 Americans? Americans. Not to mention 100,000 Iraqis. Why have I not heard about this? Why have I not heard about the fact that James Sensenbrenner, who cut off debate, you know, a couple of days ago, the Sensenbrenner meltdown we talked about in this program, has denied Conyers a committee hearing room. John Conyers, the senior ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, he's been on the House Judiciary Committee since Watergate. I mean, John Conyers has been around Congress forever. He's a solid guy. He is so beloved in his district in southeastern Michigan, in the Detroit area. He is so beloved. Every year they send him back. He is a statesman, this guy. He's made that transition. He doesn't have to be a politician anymore. Who's going to beat him? Nobody. The guy is brilliant, and he's solid. And so he's stepping out and he's saying, "I want to look into this. I want to look into this." Sensenbrenner's deputy chief of staff let minority members, that's Democrats, know that they couldn't ask for committee rooms to hold hearings with the following email. "I'm sitting here watching your forum on C-SPAN just to let you know it was your last. Don't bother asking for a room again." All right. How dare you look into this? If you'd like to call your member of Congress or Mr. Sensenbrenner's office, the toll-free number for Congress, 1-877-SOB-USOB. 1-877-SOB, the letter U-S-O-B, will get you to the Capitol Hill operator, the switchboard for the House, the Senate, and the White House. And you can simply ask for whichever person in whichever branch you want and give them your thoughts on this. You might certainly want to let John Conyers know that you support what he's doing. Let Sensenbrenner know that you think that he's acting like, shall we say, pond scum? Is that polite? Polite enough? He's acting inappropriate. Let's just put it that way. It's just terribly, terribly inappropriate. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for our rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to North Carolina, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, Live 365's American FM, and on cable systems in 29 states on CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. Glad to have you here with us. Our telephone number, by the way, toll-free across the United States, 866-889-8894. Outside the United States, 503-248-0620. And the live chat room, if you want to drop in and participate with some of the finest minds on the whole entire Internet, who are all going, Jim Dean, Jim Dean, right now, just go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. And, yes, I pre-announced you, Jim. Hey, welcome.
John, thanks for having me on. It's good to talk to you again.
Oh, it's great to have you. Jim Dean is the head of Democracy for America, democracyforamerica.com. And you guys, there's a bunch going on here. The Healthy Communities Campaign, what you're up to with Walmart, Howard and the right-wing attacks, the Downing Street memo. I want to cover all these topics here. First of all, I want to say, please tell your brother, on my behalf, go get him, keep at it. Did you see the piece I wrote for Common Dreams last Friday about Howard Dean?
I have not seen it yet.
Okay.
I've been traveling, so I'm a little bit behind on the stuff I'd like to read up on.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure if it's scrolled off Common Dreams by now or not. It's, sometimes their scroll rate is 4 or 5 days. Sometimes it goes a week. But basically, I wrote a piece on Friday saying that I called the DNC on Friday morning. I came into the office here. It was 5 o'clock in the morning Pacific time. And I just, it had been bugging me, all this trashing of your brother Howard Dean in the media. And so I called up the DNC and I said, I just want to let you know that, I support Howard Dean and I think it's great and we need somebody out there speaking the truth. And, like Harry Truman said, I never gave anybody hell. I just told the truth and they thought it was hell. And the woman says, well, that's very nice of you. And then it suddenly popped into my head, I need to do something tangible. And I said, can you transfer me to somebody who can take my credit card number and I'll give you some money? And she said, yes, I can do that. And boom, I'm over there to, somebody else in some other building or wherever they are. And I gave him $10. And I realized $10 is not a lot of money. But,
that's huge, man. I mean, that's, first of all, you're really nice to do that. I really appreciate it. But secondly, the reason I say it's huge is my understanding, and we don't talk too much about this kind of stuff, but from what I'm getting, the information in the papers, they're changing the entire, donor structure in the party with this, and they're doing very much what they did in the campaign, and if they succeed, that party's going to be a heck of a lot better for it.
Yeah,
so.
So I wrote this op-ed piece for Common Dreams saying I just gave $10 to the Democratic Party, and I gave it to them because I want them to know that I support Howard Dean, and I encourage you to do the same. And Common Dreams has about 8 million readers, and so hopefully, if my email is any indication, this is probably the first piece that I've written in a couple of years. I write for them fairly regularly that hasn't produced hey, you're dumb, or, hate mail, or people trying to argue with me, which I was expecting. Instead,
yeah.
I've gotten a lot of emails from people saying, I just called him up and I gave him $10. I called him up and I gave him $20. I called him up and I gave him $50. And most of these people add what I added, which is that I'm not a Democrat. These people, and a lot of these folks are not Democrats, but we realize that the Democratic Party is the only thing that can take back this country from the Republicans. We do live in a two-party system. And so while I have to retain my independence, or I think that I do as a talk show host and as an author, and so I can't, nonetheless, I support the Democratic Party and what they're doing, or some of what they're doing. I mean, I certainly don't support those bozos in the Democratic Party who voted for the bankruptcy bill, but, that's a whole other thing. In any case,
this is great. As a matter of fact, we've got the bat up ourselves, and we decided we'd take this occasion to do something about the Downing Street memos and the the super secret memo that followed it, and try to get that and do something about getting that out as far and wide to the public as possible. And we thought this would be a good way of responding to some of those attacks on my brother. So. And that's going real well, and that's just going to give us something else that we can do and be effective at. And you got to take a negative and turn it into a positive. And
there you go.
Anytime we can all do that, we're going to make this thing work.
Well, and I think one of the reasons why the cons are so much trying to say, oh, look at Howard Dean, he's gone off the edge, therefore he shouldn't be the head of the DNC, is because. is because there's something, you know, P.T. Barnum was right. I don't care what they say about me just so long as they spell my name right. You know,
yeah.
There's no such thing as bad publicity.
Yeah.
Every time, you know, Howard says something that the press spins around as being outrageous, and frankly, I've thought that all the things he's said so far have been true. But nonetheless, he says something that the right-wingers like Chris Matthews in the media spin around as, you know, oh my God, look at this, you know, trying to do their caricature of him. It gives him, you know, gets his name out there again. It gives him another opportunity. And that's hurting the Republican Party. And that's why you've got the Republicans saying, hey, Democrats, you ought to get rid of him. I mean, I think it's very significant that he's the only candidate for president as a Democrat in the primaries that the Republicans spent $1 million trying to take down.
Yeah. Well, it's a real interesting thing. I mean, I sort of view this in a couple of different ways. And one is that, you know, Howard is, you know, he's a guy that's deeply committed to changing how politics is done in this country. And he happens to be working in a social network right now in Washington that controls the way politics is done in this country. And they get very uncomfortable with him because he's an outsider.
Yeah.
And they tend to give him all that scrutiny. And the Republicans have been very good at leveraging that. I mean, they're the alphas of this social network in Washington. And they're very good at keeping the Democrats worried, especially incumbent Democrats who's, you know, make these moves basically based on what will the Republicans say. And you know, they've done a good job of keeping everybody in check. But as long as Howard, I think, is out there, and as long as us and so many other really great groups doing work out there are still getting these new candidates in and supporting ground up build up of this party, we're going to be fine. Howard's mandate comes from the state parties, and they're already seeing the benefits of his attempt to make it the party a 50 state party and to reach out into places where Democrats haven't been reaching out. And they're pretty pleased, from what I understand, with what's going on. And if we develop that outside of Washington constituency, we will eventually prevail.
There you go. Jim, the last time we spoke and saw each other, in fact, was
yep.
Here in Portland for the Democracy for Oregon group. You've got Democracy for, fill in the name of the state, groups all over the country. But Democracy for America is the big one, democracyforamerica.com, for our listeners who want to check it out and get more information. And Democracy for America has rolled out a campaign called the Healthy Communities Campaign. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Well, this is really it's a campaign or a concept that encompasses a lot of different things that are surrounding around things like health care for everybody, affordable health care for everyone, and environmental responsibility and social responsibility, particularly among business leaders and corporations like Walmart, which is very much sort of tied into this. We're part of the number of groups, about 14 or 15 of them right now, that are on this campaign to make Walmart a better American company. And that's sort of where the healthy communities thing started to come in. And we're going to be doing more work, particularly in the healthcare area, so that companies like Walmart don't basically use the taxpayers' money to fund their employees' health care, which is what's going on right now. And, of course, it's an outrage. One of the biggest things that I think tears away at the fabric of this society is the lack of leadership from our business leaders. They're not accountable, particularly in big corporations. We've just seen General Motors, for example, being mismanaged. They're now making products that people don't want to buy. And the first response that they have to this is not to hold themselves accountable, but to blame the employees and say that their health care costs are too high.
Right, and ship more jobs to China.
Exactly. And we're not valuing the capital or labor. We're not valuing the culture of labor anymore, particularly among bigger business. Healthy communities, one of the things that Healthy Communities is trying to do, particularly when singling out Walmart, is to try to bring those values back into the American mainstream, because I think the Republican leadership and, unfortunately, too many of our business leaders have really tried to work it the other way.
And people can find out more information about this by going to democracyforamerica.com, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Jim, do you mind taking a call from a listener?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, listener calls here. Our toll-free telephone number, if you'd like to say hi or ask a question of Jim Dean, Howard Dean's brother, the head of democracyforamerica.com, is 1-866-889-8894. Lynn in Eureka, California, you're live with Jim Dean.
Was that me?
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Dean, I'm a little concerned about the Democratic Party. They're not apparently concerned about the problems with the voting machines. It's kind of like it doesn't seem to whenever we talk to them about it, they just kind of shrug it off.
Okay, I don't think they're shrugging it off, and I can tell you, having been to about 15 to 20 state organizing conferences, this is the one question that I get all the time and the most often. I think a lot of the voting machine, or what I call ballot integrity issues, are being dealt with on a state level right now, and I understand about the HAVA stuff, but there are a number of ballots or legislative measures underway in state legislatures this year that address this, and I know a lot of Democracy for America groups have chosen to get very involved in that so they can restore integrity to the ballot and restore integrity to the process. But nonetheless, it has been more of a local effort and probably less so on the part of federal effort.
Yeah, what I think. Thanks a lot for the call and the comment, Lynn. I'm waiting, Jim, for somebody, and hope for some conservative or somebody posing as a conservative to write an op-ed pointing out that your brother, along with Bev Harris on the Topic A with Tina Brown program, hacked a voting machine. In fact, here's a little clip from it.
Bev sat me down, and in a few short seconds, I was amazed at what I could do.
All right, Bev, show me how to do this.
And, and then it just continues, and he goes on, and he hacks a voting machine right there on live TV. It took him 90 seconds to change the outcome of an election. So somebody needs to write an op-ed or a news story for one of the right-wing publications like Newsmax saying, hey, the Democrats have figured out how to hack the voting machines. We better look out. And as soon as the Republicans start thinking that the Democrats might get into the machines, I have a feeling the machines will all be gone the next week.
You're probably right. But I share Lynn's concern because there isn't a national coalesce movement on this right now, but that's it's part of what's going on as we're all kind of coming together. A lot of groups are coming together to work on issues like this, but it's not it hasn't been an overnight process, and of course we've had two elections where this has been a real problem, so I understand that, and locally it's happening, and hopefully we can bubble that up to more in the national effort to make sure that the voters don't forget about this problem.
Right.
Because ultimately we're going to need their help in this thing to get it solved.
Jim, we've got to take a break. Can you stay with us until the bottom of the hour?
Sure, love to.
Okay, Mary in Michigan, we got about 30 seconds here. If you've got a quick question, maybe Jim can think about it over the break and get back with you on it.
Yes.
Go for it, Mary.
With the Downing Street Minutes information finally coming out, but the Republican Party saying it's completely dismissed, it never happened, how do we prove to them that it really did take place?
Okay, do we do this before the break or after?
Yeah, well, we've got 5 seconds, but this is a really important issue, and Mary, thank you for raising that, and we'll have Jim's thoughts on that when we come back from this break. I'm sorry we have the tyranny of the clock here, but we're talking with Jim Dean. He's the what's your title there with Democracy for America?
I think it's chair, actually.
Chairman, okay.
The one that I'm sitting in, anyway.
Okay, he's the chair, or he's sitting on the chair of democracyforamerica.com. You can check it out on the Internet. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and we're talking with Jim Dean, the chair of democracyforamerica.com. And Jim, before we go to Sheldon's question from Salisbury, Maryland, you want to take a whack at the comment? I believe it was Mary asked about, what are your thoughts on the Downing Street memo?
Well, first of all, this is from a very credible source, a source that really is unassailable. And the biggest thing that we need to do is get it out to far and wide to all our friends and neighbors. One of the reasons we had the bat up today on our website is to raise money to get the Downing Street memo into the consciousness of the public population at large, either through billboards, either through newspaper flyers or radio commercials. But we're going to keep doing this because the most sacred responsibility that any president can have is the responsibility over the decision to send our troops into battle. And this president was either incompetent about it, dishonest about it, or both. And we need to make sure that he's held accountable to this so that it doesn't happen again. After Vietnam, we thought it wouldn't happen again after Lyndon Johnson, but now we got a guy that's made Lyndon Johnson look like President Eisenhower or General Eisenhower, and we got to really ensure that we don't have this again. So please, if you have this memo, if you've downloaded it, send it out to your friends and neighbors and talk about it. We need to get into the stream of consciousness. There's a lot of other things that are going to help out with that and bolster that, the Bolton hearings for one, and some of the other testimony that's come out about the misconduct of President Bush in this war. But we need to get this memo out, and it's a very clear and probably the clearest indication of the malfeasance of this administration in prosecuting the war in Iraq.
Yeah, and John Conyers holding hearings on that tomorrow, so that's something.
God bless him for that, too.
Amen. We'll be talking about that. Sheldon in Salisbury, Maryland, you're live with Jim Dean.
Hi, Tom. Mr. Dean, honored to speak to you. I'm an organizer of Salisbury Democracy for America here.
Oh, great.
And I just wanted to tell you that several of us went up to D.C. this past weekend, or on Friday, actually, and spoke to Congressman Hoyer's staff, Gilchrist and Cardin, and urged them to support Rush Holt's bill. How do you think that's going? And I wanted to speak on the voting reform a question that was asked earlier.
Uh-huh.
And a comment that came up during the conference this past weekend is that voting reform is the one reform that makes all other reform possible.
Yeah, there you go.
Right.
It's like Thomas Paine saying that the vote is the beating heart of democracy.
Yeah, it's true. And it's an odd thing because it's a national problem, but it's governed by the states. And that's kind of what I think a lot of people have been working through right now. And one of the reasons that I'm so glad that there's so many organizations are working on that. But again, my concern about this is that we do need to do something nationally about it so that it again stays in the public consciousness. Because if it goes away 6 months or a year after the election, like I think it did for many people after 2000. All of a sudden, you know, we're back where we started from, and we can't tolerate that
anymore. Yeah, to this day, I'm convinced that the vote in Georgia was hacked in 2002 and that Max Cleland actually won. And I will continue to say that on the record because there seems to be so much evidence of it in my mind. And, of course, nobody's investigated it because the Republicans, that's how they took back the Senate. And thus, no investigations. They already controlled the House. But that's, anyhow, if people want, we got to wrap this up. If people want to contribute to the effort to get the word out about the Downing Street memo, this being one of the things you're focusing on, or
yep.
if they want to contribute to participate in trying to make Walmart a more American company, the Healthy Communities campaign, which actually goes way beyond just Walmart, they can
yep.
do it by going to democracyforamerica.com and participating there, right?
Yeah, that's great. And we're going to be at this for a while, along with supporting about another 50 candidates this year and hopefully giving money away to a lot more candidates who are running for local office because, as Howard used to say all the time, politics is too important to be left to the professionals,
yeah.
and it's not a spectator sport.
There you go. So get out there, get involved. You can start out by going to democracyforamerica.com. Jim Dean, thanks so much for being with us today.
Tom, thank you so much for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. It's my honor. It's
great. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. Great talking with you, Jim. It's the Tom Hartman Radio program for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. The radio support group of, by, and for We the People.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. I just for the record, and then I'm going to move on. But just for the record, I want to play this. It's a 2-minute clip, and you know normally talk radio 2 minutes. 2 minutes is a long time, But this is a two-minute clip of Howard Dean hacking a voting machine on live national television. And I think it's amazing that so many people have forgotten that this happened, and that when it did happen, there wasn't one single major national news organization that covered the story. So I just want to play this clip for you, and then I want to go on to Marine recruiters and what they're up to. But you've just got to hear this. This is just awesome.
Bev sat me down, and in a few short seconds, I was amazed at what I could do.
All right, Bev, show me how to do this.
Well, what we have here is the central tabulator computer. Now, in a voting system, you have all these different voting machines at all the different polling places. Sometimes, in a county like mine, there's 1,000 polling places in one county. All those machines feed into the one machine so it can add up all the votes. So, of course, if you were going to do something you shouldn't to a voting machine, would it be more convenient to do it to the 4,000 machines or to just come in here to one machine and deal with all of them at once? What surprises people is the central tabulator is just a PC. It's like you and I use. It uses Windows. It's just a regular computer.
So anybody who can hack into a PC can hack into the central tabulator.
The GEMS program is the program that is the central tabulator program. And I'm going to put in a password here. Okay, we're in. Now, this is the official program that the county supervisor sees.
Is this the DEBO program?
Yes, this is a DEBO central tabulation program.
Okay.
And then go to election summary report. And it's kind of where and spin for a minute while it adds up all the votes from all the different precincts. And you can see here, Howard Dean has 1,000 votes. And Lex Luthor has 500. So you're beating Lex Luthor, and we're...
2-1.
Yes. And Tiger Woods, unfortunately, doesn't have any votes yet.
All right.
All right. Let's close this out. I was just showing you the way to go in and look at votes, which, of course, you can't tamper with. Go to the Start menu, and I'm going to show you something tricky. And I want you to go to My Computer and just click that. And you're going to see some come up, go to Local Disk C, go to GEMS, which is the name of the DEBO program. You're going to go to Local DB, which stands for Local Database. That's where they keep the votes. And by the way, this has been out on the Internet for ages now. Go to Central Tabulator Votes, which is the database we just looked at. And then go to the Sum of the Candidates, which is that table. You see we have 800 votes here for you and 400 for Lex Luthor. Let's just flip those. We'll make that 400. And we'll give 100 votes to Tiger. Let's just see what happened here. We'll go back into GEMS the legitimate way. You're the county supervisor. You're checking on the progress of your election. And as you can see now, Howard Dean only has 500 votes. Lex Luthor has 900 and Tiger Woods has 100 votes. Hmm. We just edited an election. It took us 90 seconds.
And left no traces whatsoever. Left no traces whatsoever. There you go. Howard Dean and Bev Harris on live national television hacking a Diebold voting machine, changing the outcome of an election in an untraceable fashion, and not one single news organization in the United States thought it was worthy of mention as a story. You get how bad the situation is? That was on Topic A with Tina Brown, a program that has now been canceled from CNBC. And one wonders to what extent Tina Brown's politics may have had something to do with that as well. CNBC, of course, also owned by NBC, also owned by General Electric, the marvelous purveyor of nuclear power plants and weapons systems to the United States and the world. Speaking of weapons systems, this from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. A columnist by the name of Susan Painter wrote this, and it's so startling that I just want to share it with you, more or less straight up. For mom Marcia Cobb and her teenage son Axel, the white letters USMC on their caller ID soon spelled "Don't answer the phone." Marine recruiters began a relentless barrage of calls to Axel. This is a local story in Seattle. You're talking about that. Axel is the kid, right? As soon as the mellow, compliant, Cedro Woolley high school grad had cut his 17th birthday cake. And soon it was nearly impossible to get the seekers of a few good men off the line. With early and late calls ringing in their ears, Marcia tried using call blocking. And that's when she learned her first hard lesson. You can't block calls from the government, her telephone server said. So after pleas to please stop calling went unanswered, the family's "do not answer" order ensued. But warnings and liquid crystal lettering can fade, so 2 weeks ago when Marcia was cooking dinner, Alex goofed and answered the phone. And faster than you can say Semper Fi, an odyssey kicked into action that illustrates just how desperate some of the recruiters we've read about really are to fill severely sagging quotas. And this is Susan Painter writing this in the Seattle Post Intelligencer. She says, let what we learn serve as a warning to other moms, dads, and teens, the Cobbs now say. Even if your kids actually may want to join the military, if you hope to do it on their own terms, after deep breath and due consideration, repeat these words often to them. No, not now, and back off. Axel, this is the kid, he says, I've been trained to be pretty friendly. I guess you might even say I'm kind of passive. Well, the next step, you know, this, he told the reporter this last week, just after his mother and older sister had tracked him to a Seattle testing center and sprung him on a ruse. The next step of Axel's, now get the story. This is like plot within plot. I mean, this is like playing out, like they should make a movie about this. There are subplots within subplots here. Axel had heard about a cool chin-up contest in Bellingham, Washington. Okay, this is a contest. See how many chin-ups you can do, and the winner gets to win a free Xbox. You know, the video game thing. And so he's now 18 years old. He's going to Skagit Valley Community College. He dragged his tail feathers home uncharacteristically late that night. In the morning, Marcia learned, his mother, that the Marines had hosted the event, and then they had him out all night. They kept him up all night, drilling him to join the Marine Corps. This is a single mom. She raised her kids on a farm where, until recently, she grew salad greens for restaurants. His father, who was a Marine, who served in Vietnam, died when Alex was 4 years old. Interestingly, the recruiters knew all about both of these things. They knew how his mother made a living. They knew that his dad had been a Marine and how and when he died. They said to him, this is what the Marine recruiters said to this 18-year-old kid. You don't want to be a burden to your mom, they told him. Be a man. Make your father proud. Never mind that because of his own experience in the service, Marcia says that the last thing Axel's dad would have wanted would be for his father, for his son, for Axel to have enlisted in the Marine Corps. The next weekend, when Marcia went to Seattle for the Folklife Festival and Alex was home alone, don't leave your kids alone when the Marine recruiters are around, two Marine recruiters showed up at the door. Axel tried to tell him no. He said, not interested, and tried to close the door on their face. The sergeant snapped. He turned surly, and he yelled at Axel. He said, you're making a big bleeping mistake. Bleeping, of course, you know, replaced by the appropriate expletive. So anyhow, they left. The next thing they know, Axel's working at a restaurant. It's called the Connor Brewing Company. Next thing they know, they show up there while he's working. Same sergeant and another recruiter. And before Axel, an older cousin, and other co-workers knew or understood what was happening, they get Axel out and they put him in a car and they drive off with him. Axel says, they said we were going somewhere. I didn't know we were going all the way to Seattle. Right, they're driving him, you know, like 100 miles away. Just to take a few tests, they said. So many free opportunities. He could pursue his love of chemistry. He could serve anywhere he wanted. He could leave anytime he wanted on an apathy discharge if he didn't like it. He wouldn't even have to go to Iraq if he didn't want to, they told him. At 3:30 in the morning, Alex was awakened in the motel and fed a little food. 12 hours later, without further sleep or food, he had taken a battery of tests and signed a lot of papers he hadn't gotten a chance to read. Just formalities, he was told. Sign here, he was told. Oh, and sign here. Nothing to worry about. Now, while he's going through this, his mother has figured out that, you know, while she was out of town, he'd been kidnapped by the Marine Corps, and she's freaking out. She goes over to the Burlington Recruiting Center. The door's open. There's nobody there. So she grabs all the cards and phone numbers she could find, including the address of the Seattle Area Testing Center. And then with her grown daughter in tow, she hightails it south, frantically phoning Alex, whose cell phone has been confiscated by the Marine recruiters, quote, so he wouldn't be distracted during the tests, end quote. She gets to the Marine Testing Center, and they tell her she can't see her son. So she tells them, she lies. She tells them that his grandfather is in the hospital dying at that very moment, and he needs to come home right away to say goodbye to his grandfather. It's not true. She says she would have said just about anything. She thought that would get her in the door. But even after, so they go back and they tell the Marines this, but instead of bringing Axel out, her daughter is like going around the corner looking down another corridor, and she sees him being taken down a separate hall into another room. They're trying to get him out of the area so that he can't, his mother won't see him. This is like the Moonies. His mother runs down the hall and grabs his arm, and they're yelling, "Be a man! Stand up to your family!" Turns out, because he'd signed a few papers that he thought were the authorization to give him a test, that what he really needed was a lawyer. $250 for an attorney. And the Marines relented. The reporter tried to talk to the Burlington office of the Marine Corps. They said, no thanks. Didn't return the calls. So should your phone, Marsha Cobb advised, ring and say USMC, take your own sweet time, keep your own counsel, and if you see USMC on caller ID, remember what answering that call could mean. Susan Painter, P-A-Y-N-T-E-R, the article, column in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. You can read it online, seattlepi.nwsource.com is the website. I had a friend, I have a friend, actually one of my very closest friends, Hilly Zeitlin. He's a psychotherapist in Baltimore, Maryland. He runs the Maryland Center for Ericksonian Hypnosis and Psychotherapy. And Hilly used to work with Ted Patrick, the deprogrammer, you know, the guy who would kidnap people from cults and deprogram them. And before that, he had been in a cult himself, the 14-year-old kid who claimed that he was the perfect master. I forget his name. Anyhow, this was like, you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And Hilly has just told me some wild stories about how the cults react when you try and grab people and deprogram them and stuff like that, and, you know, things like that. And it's like the Marine Corps has been taking lessons from the Moonies. I mean, do you get this? They're recruiters. They're taking lessons from the Moonies, which actually makes a lot of sense when you consider that Reverend Moon is one of the major supporters of the Republican Party in the United States, and that the Washington Times, which he owns, and Tony Blankley, who works for him, one of his toadies, who's regularly on the McLaughlin Report and on other TV shows all around the country, you know, out there pushing the Iraq War. And, of course, Reverend Moon, you know, made his first fortune, or a good chunk of it, in the weapons business. Now he's in the business of going around getting Christian churches to take the cross off the roof and replace it with a crown and bury the cross in the ground. There's a whole website about it, a Mooney website, I mean, you know, proclaiming the wonders of it. Because Reverend Moon says he's here, he's now come to finish the work that Jesus started and failed, according to Reverend Moon. He is the true father. And he's the guy who publishes the newspaper, which George W. Bush says is the only paper he'll read. He's the guy who paid hundreds of thousands of dollars in speaker's fees to George W. Bush's father, George Herbert Walker Bush. He's the guy who was crowned Messiah in the Senate office building by a member of the United States Congress, in a room that was signed for by John Warner, Senator John Warner, Republican of Virginia. So the Reverend Moon and his tactics and his strategies have migrated, shall we say. I mean, you know, what worked fine for 15-year-old kids who, you know, had run away from home or were thinking about it? Get them into the Mooney cult. Seems to work just fine for 17-year-olds who aren't quite sure what to do with their lives. After all, the Bush administration has so completely screwed up the economy. I mean, you know, what are you going to do? This kid is looking. He's working as a waiter in a bar and grill. What kind of job opportunities are there left in America? And now they want to sign CAFTA. They're pushing CAFTA through to bring 44 million additional people in Central America into the workforce here in North America. North and Central America, so that the 105, 110 million American workers can compete with 44 million Central American workers. Oh, but they're going to want to buy our stuff, the cons will tell you. Yes, they have a combined purchasing power equal to that of New Haven, Connecticut. Not a lot of money down there in Central America. I'm sorry. A lot of those folks are just living on their, you know, living just by the, you know, just on the edge. Subsistence farmers. But, boy, will they be pleased to work for $2 an hour. Or maybe even a dollar an hour. Just think. I mean, here in Oregon, they even got the Democrat, Ron Wyden. Gordon Smith, of course, the Republican. You expect that he'd go for it. They even got the Democrat. Well, Nike's here and Intel. Of course, you know, cheap labor. That's the name of the game. So, you know, what do you expect? So as the jobs go away, what are we left with? Well, there's the Marines. And if you're a little reluctant, well, there's Mooney recruiting strategies. Somehow it all just fits together so well with the cult that is called modern conservatism. 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Come all you good workers, good news to you I'll tell of how the good old union has come in here to dwell.
Yeah, which side are you going to be on?
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
Ultimately, this is what it's coming down to, my friends. It's unfortunate, but this is what it's coming down to. Is that, as Warren Buffett said, class war has been declared, and he said his class is winning. And it's just time to wake up, time to wake people up to the fact that America has been sold down the tubes by people calling themselves conservatives who Barry Goldwater wouldn't recognize, who Dwight Eisenhower would throw out of the building. The Senate yesterday confirmed Thomas Griffith to a seat on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. This, one of the Toxic Seven, part of the original Toxic Ten. Apparently, most senators now are no longer bothered by the fact that this guy was practicing law with a suspended license in D.C., practicing law in Utah without even bothering to get a Utah law license. And back in 1999, when there were 10 judges on the D.C. Circuit, this is the first circuit, this is the circuit court before which come cases about federal issues. If somebody, you know, somebody wants to say, hey, we should shut down the EPA, or Dow Chemical says the EPA doesn't have the right to do this, or somebody says we, you know, the Labor Department should not exist, or the Labor Department, you know, it can't advocate for union, whatever. It all ends up in the D.C. Circuit because it has to do with federal law. The D.C. Circuit handles most of the cases that have to do with federal law. And back in 1999, when there were 10 judges on the D.C. Circuit, and there was quite a caseload. Bill Clinton wanted to nominate somebody for the D.C. Circuit, put an 11th judge on there. The Republicans said, no, you can't do that. Now, that would be packing the court. Griffith is now the 11th judge. You get it? He's now the 11th judge. We need to call this court packing scheme what it is. It's court packing. And it's what they're doing with the circuit courts. And it's what they're intending to do with the Supreme Court. The cons are intent on court packing. Why? Because they want to roll back the New Deal. Why? Because they think it's socialism. They think there's something inherently wrong with there being a strong middle class in America because they don't trust we the people. They want there to be an elite group of CEOs who run the country through the politicians that they own, period. And they believe that that'll bring about social stability. Yeah, their intentions are good, social stability, but I'm sorry, the outcome is wrong, and it's just not the right way to do it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Exposes political corruption and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where reason and passion go together like Republican presidents and gay hookers and now porn stars. Yes, Mary Carey last night paid her $5,000 to George W. Bush so he would do what he does when people give him money. He would hang out with them. He would do what they want. The Republican Party. The perfect party for Mary Carey. I mean, it's just the absolute perfect party. I was discussing this earlier in the chat room or on the local radio program that I do before this national program here in Portland, Oregon. And somebody in the chat room commented that, that this person thought that strippers and porn stars were probably Democrats rather than Republicans. And because they would have more, quote, you know, open minds or liberal or whatever. And you could argue, I suppose, that strippers are performers. And I suppose you could argue that porn stars are as well. But, what they're doing for money is not that different from what Republicans do for money. It's just the Republicans do it to us, to America. Well, anyhow, enough of that. I need not go on. You get the point. A growing number of senior American military officers in Iraq. Not from The Nation, not from In These Times, not from some left-wing publication. This from Knight Ridder Newspapers. Quoting generals in the U.S. military, a growing number of senior American military officers in Iraq have concluded that there is no long-term military solution to an insurgency that has killed thousands of Iraqis and more than 1,700 U.S. military personnel during the past 2 years. Instead, the officers say the only way to end the guerrilla war is through Iraqi politics. Brigadier General Donald Alston, the chief U.S. military spokesman in Iraq, said last week, "I think the more accurate way to approach this right now is to concede that this insurgency is not going to be settled. The terrorists and the terrorism in Iraq is not going to be settled through military options or military operations. It's going to be settled in the political process." Then why are we still there? It is not that foreign terrorists are coming into the country to take pot shots at Americans, because, boy, wouldn't that be fun, and there's just all kinds of people out there who want to kill Americans. No, I'm sorry. That's not the case. If that was the case, first of all, you would see Americans being killed all over the world. And by and large, it's not happening. The terror that the Bush administration would like you to live in is unnecessary. You're more likely to be stuck up by somebody who wants what's in your wallet than somebody who cares about your nationality when you travel in the third world. I speak with some experience there. And secondly, when you occupy a country, the occupied tend to resist. This is why the British don't have India as part of their empire anymore. Or Uganda or Kenya or, you know, name your African country. Egypt. It's why the French don't have Algeria anymore. Or the Sudan. It's why the Belgians don't have the Congo anymore. It's why Portugal doesn't control Brazil. It's why Great Britain no longer controls North America. Because when people are occupied, they tend to say, you know, enough of this. And then you get terrorists like George Washington, who start taking shots at the occupiers. And the occupiers start running around going, it's not fair. They're using unorthodox techniques of warfare. Yes, that was King George III's main argument with George Washington, that he was using illegal methods. Illegal military methods. How dare they hide behind trees to shoot at our troops when we line up in formation the way good soldiers do? 1776. How dare those American terrorists do that? It is becoming so clear to the rest of the world and to many Americans now that what's going on in Iraq is not a bunch of religious loony Muslims, and I put all that in quotes, who just are dying, who just so want to blow themselves up and get to heaven that they're all of a sudden there's this epidemic of suicide bombing. No, that's not the case. If Muslims thought that the way to get to heaven was to blow themselves up, a whole lot of them would have been doing it in Iraq before we got there, and they weren't. They clearly find our presence more oppressive than Saddam's. And consider that for a minute. Unemployment is worse. The water supplies are less reliable. The electricity is less reliable. Crime is through the roof. And the American soldiers, the big transition, and this was an epiphany for me, and we talked about this on this program a week or so ago. I was interviewing, it was a couple of days ago, and it was actually on the local program. We interviewed a local filmmaker who had gone to Iraq and made an independent movie about Iraq. And he said that the change happened with the troop rotation. He was there. The first U.S. soldiers came in, they rolled in, they took out Saddam, they took out the army, they took over the country, and he said at that point the Iraqi people were like, this is great. No more Saddam. We're ready for this. And we were told, hey, you know, we come in, we're going to give you your country, and we're going to leave. And we told them that. In fact, the guy who preceded Bremer had said, we're going to hold elections. And then Bush said, no, we can't have elections. The Iraqis might elect somebody that they like and that who doesn't like us. We can't have that. We got to have a puppet government. So we're going to have caucuses, you know, like in Iowa, where local people get together and talk things out and then take a little local vote. And that's going to decide who's going to be in the Iraqi governing Congress. And by the way, we're going to decide who the people are who get to participate in the caucuses. Well, the Iraqis said, no, we're not going to put up with this. Sadr and Sistani, they took to the streets, and hundreds of thousands of Iraqis marched in the streets and said, no, we want elections. Damn it, we want elections, and we want them now. And so Bush flip-flopped and said, okay, we'll give you elections. He really had no choice. And so we had the elections, and now they're concerned. There are complaints that the elections were rigged. But, you know, be that as it may, the let me finish this story. So this fellow who made the film, he said that when those first soldiers who had essentially bonded with the Iraqis, and, you know, people were in local areas and the Iraqis weren't shooting at them. There was a time of relative peace there after May of 2003, May of, I'm mixing up my years. Anyhow, right after the May of 2003, right after the, we had taken, yeah, May of 2003, right after we had taken the city of Baghdad, you know, relative peace. And in a lot of parts of Iraq, the local people had actually bonded with these soldiers. Said, yeah, you know, good guys. They're here to liberate us. And the soldiers had said, I'm going to be leaving. And they were. They were going to be rotated out. The troops were being rotated out. There's a troop rotation coming. And so the soldiers were saying, oh, I'm on my way out. I'll see you later. Great meeting you. Have a good time. And the Iraqis thought that everybody was going to go. And little did they know when the soldiers said, we're leaving, that what they were talking about was a troop rotation. And so those soldiers left, and they were replaced by a whole different bunch of soldiers, new bunch of soldiers, by and large, who didn't speak the language, who didn't know the people, who hadn't bonded with folks, and who came, and who were coming into the beginnings of a hostile response. And that was the turning point. That was the point at which the people of Iraq said to themselves, collectively, there was one giant forehead slap all across the country. One of those light bulb goes off over their heads. One of those, oh my God, moments all across the country where the people of Iraq said, they didn't come to liberate us, they came to occupy us. And they started doing what people do, have always done throughout history when they've been occupied. Whether it was the Romans trying to occupy, you know, territories outside of Italy, or whether it was, I mean, you know, pick, you know, the Romans trying to occupy Great Britain in 56 B.C. And look at how, you know, the British fought them for 400 years, finally drove them out. With terror tactics. The British terrorists fighting against the Romans. So we're starting to, our military is figuring this out. We're not fighting radicals. We're not fighting wackos. We're not fighting religious fundamentalists. We may be creating some, but by and large, we're fighting nationalists. We're fighting people who want their nation. General George W. Casey, the top U.S. commander in Iraq, expressed similar sentiments, calling the military's efforts, quote, the Pillsbury Doughboy idea, end quote. Press the insurgency in one area only causes it to rise elsewhere. Like in Baghdad, Casey said during an interview with two newspaper reporters, including one from Knight Ridder, last week, quote, we pushed in Baghdad. They're down to less than a car bomb a day in Baghdad over the last week, but in northern or north-center Iraq, they've gone up. The political process will be the decisive element, end quote. In other words, when the Iraqis are controlling Iraq, then you're going to see a change. People will even put up with their own dictators, as long as they're their own dictators. I mean, eventually, you know, ideally they try to overthrow them. They work in different ways to do it, and eventually, usually it happens. We've gone from one democracy in the world in 1776 to a half a dozen around the time of the Civil War, to around 30 of them around 1900. To you know, more or less 100 of them now, about more or less half the nations of the world are democracies. And you know, with the exception of Germany and Japan, who went nuts, and that's a whole other rap that we've done at other times, with the exception of Germany and Japan being brought back to democracy by virtue of wars in which they overreached, the vast majority of those countries are democracies because they decided to be democracies. Say, well, what about the rest of the countries in Europe that we liberated from the Germans? Okay, I'll give you that. But they wanted to be democracies. And, you know, before the war and after the war, they had the choice. They became democracies. It wasn't that anybody had to force it on them. You know, it's Dick Gregory's old saying, when you got something good, you don't have to force it on people. They will steal it. And the Iraqis are looking at us saying, you know, let's see real democracy at work. Ultimately, I just have to say, just to close this up, I think the ultimate solution is going to be the Yugoslav solution, divided into three countries, Kurdistan in the north, the Shia in the south, the Sunnis in the center, and give each one autonomy. Then it'll work. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Ladies and gentlemen, Rush Limbaugh.
They say that I'm sleaze and elitist. You please, everybody disagrees with my rap.
It's rap.
I'm horrendous. I'm appalling. My ratings now are falling because I'm so full of bull, so full of crap.
Full of crap.
With condescending cries, making money, selling lies. You might say, everybody hates my guts.
Hates his guts.
I'm offensive, I'm a bigot, I'm a fraud, can you dig it? I'm a sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic cuts.
I'm not squeeze and I'll
say. That's right.
Ah, yes, welcome back, my friends. Who's a journalist? It all depends. The number is 27% of Americans say Rush Limbaugh is a journalist. 30% say he's say Bob Woodward is a journalist. Go figure. 40% say Bill O'Reilly's a journalist. Limbaugh says he's not really surprised by the survey. Quote, Rush Limbaugh, I am America's anchorman doing news play-by-play 15 hours a week for nearly 17 years now, and this is just more evidence that the old media's monopoly-like dominance is finished. Yes, so when they asked people, Americans, what are the perceived goals of big media corporations, 48% of the public said the first priority of media corporations is to make profits for their owners. And 46% said it was to deliver high-quality news coverage. Among journalists, only 12% of journalists said the top priority of corporate owners was to provide factual and timely coverage of the news. Go figure. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number. But first, we have Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service with our report for the day from Washington, D.C. You were in the White House press room?
I was, yes, indeed.
Did you get to ask a question again today?
Well, barely. In fact, I could only hold the phone with one hand because the other hand is holding my face, which is so red from the slap that was administered it by Scott McClellan during the briefing.
Uh-huh.
Because I was naughty.
Uh-oh.
I asked a question about Downing Street.
Oh, my. Oh, my. And what happened? What happened?
I didn't even get my question out. I didn't even finish it. I was asking about the hearings tomorrow and whether the president was pleased to hear that they're investigating. I had a whole thing.
Yeah.
You've already asked that question. President's addressed it. Next!
Oh, well, we're doing our best to publicize it.
Was me. Done.
Yeah. Well, sorry about that. Anything interesting happening in Washington today, Victoria, beyond that?
Have they
got a room for tomorrow's hearings?
I believe. Let me just check with my producer. Do they have a room for the hearings tomorrow yet? Do you know, Sarah? We don't know yet. No, they may be.
C-SPAN has announced on their homepage that they're going to be covering them on C-SPAN 3, which is a channel that most people don't have on their cable systems.
That's right. Like C-SPAN 16. No. So Sarah says they don't yet have a room. So who knows where they're going to? They'll find somewhere because the story's going to build.
Right. It'll be the broom closet on the fourth floor of the left corner of the Everett Dirksen building.
Exactly. And that makes the story even better. I mean, they're so foolish not to. It's fascinating to see how this is being handled so very, very badly.
Yeah.
But Scott McClellan was ticked off with everybody today. He's been ticked off since this morning's gaggle after a question was asked about Philip Cooney, the former chief of staff to the White House Council on Environmental Quality.
Right, who's now working for ExxonMobil.
Yeah.
What a surprise. Did anybody ask him about Mary Carey? What kind of impression she made on the president?
No. I was thinking that Les Consulting would have asked that question. He didn't. I actually saw Mary Carey the day before as she went into the White House.
Right.
Well, I say saw her. You couldn't really avoid seeing her. She's a big girl.
Yeah.
Very big girl. So we didn't hear it today, but he was getting ticked off with Les for asking questions about that on Monday because he was asking about that, and the previous week was asking about that, so who knows?
Yeah, yeah.
He was ticked off when people started asking about Guantanamo Bay. Well, that annoyed him because that's already been asked and answered. Basically, from what I can gather, there's really no point him even holding the briefings anymore because everything's always been asked and answered.
So Scotty is he's not in a good mood and he's not answering questions.
I would say so. Yes, yeah. And also he's ticked off, as you know, that people are asking about the president's statements last night at this massive fundraiser that the Democrats are the party of no.
Oh yeah. Well, this is the new frame that the Republicans are going to try and use. You know, it actually worked well for the Democrats when they framed Gingrich at one point as an obstructionist. So the Republicans are going to try it out. Victoria Jones, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
For the report. Good to hear from you. And our report for the day from Washington, D.C., Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, 29 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 27 minutes before the hour. The place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, the Tom Hartman radio program. The leader of a conservative Christian lobby group appears to suggest that gays should be required to wear warning labels. The Family Research Institute, the notoriously gay, anti-gay conservative Family Research Institute, the New York leader, Mr. Benucci, comes out and says, you know, just like tobacco. He says, we put warning labels on cigarette packs because we know that smoking takes 1 to 2 years off the average lifespan, yet we celebrate a lifestyle that we know spreads every kind of sexually transmitted disease, blah-de-blah-de-blah. Says Reverend Bill Benucci, executive director of the New York Christian Coalition. He told the Mid-Hudson News. Yeah. Pink triangles. That's what it. That's the solution. Pink triangles. I mean, sometimes you think that the world these guys want to take us to is just absolutely spooky. It is just absolutely spooky. It's over the top. Speaking of, you know, the world and how it should be framed, how it should be viewed. Jeffrey Feldman has a website. He calls the Frame Shop is Open, frameshopisopen.com. And he's doing some really good work on these NLP concepts that George, I'm forgetting George's last name. Anyhow, that have been worked out by this guy, the professor out in California. And I know someone in the chat room is just going to be shouting it at me. It's one of those moments. In any case, who has come up with the idea that there are, that the frames are the most important things, that it's not the information, it's not even the truth or the accuracy of the information, it is the frame that is used to convey the information. And he points out that lately the Democrats have been focusing a lot on the Downing Street memo. It's like the Democrats all think, hey, the Downing Street memo, this is what's going to do it. This is going to be the thing that is going to push us over the edge. George Lakoff, thank you very much. Thank you, Sue. This is going to be the thing that pushes folks over the edge. And Jeffrey Feldman suggests, no, don't think so. Not the case. Ain't going to be the case. He says, unfortunately, it's not going to work. He says, basically, what's going to happen is the memo is going to get some play, and, you know, John Conyers will hold his hearings, and everybody will say, okay, well, yeah, Bush decided to take us to war, and he lied to us when he was saying things, you know, that you know, clearly untrue. He was telling us that he was not going to take us to war, that he lied. You know, we will come to that conclusion. That, you know, when he said
we're headed to war in Iraq, I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
When he said that back in 2002, late 2002, he was lying to us. He had already decided. In fact, according to the latest memos to come out of Downing Street, the decision was made in March or April of 2002. But, of course, you wouldn't roll it out. Remember Paul Wolfowitz's famous saying, you don't roll things out, new products out in the summer? They wouldn't roll it out until the fall. And why? Well, because there was an election coming in 2002. You know, I've been telling you all along, the reason that we went to war in Iraq was all about elections and power. Yes, it got them oil, and they wanted the oil. But if they didn't hold control of the House and Senate, they couldn't have gotten the oil because they couldn't have gotten the war. If Bush couldn't hold the White House in 2004, they couldn't be war profiteering because Kerry would have gotten us out of that mess. It's all about power. It's all about oil. It's all about wealth. But ultimately, behind it all, it's all about winning the elections to get that power and that wealth and that money. So anyhow, Feldman says, you know, we're dealing with this at the level of information. He lied. And isn't that a terrible thing? And ultimately what the Republicans are going to say is, well, yeah, maybe he lied. So what? You know, that's what politicians do. I mean, at the very worst, the Republicans will come out and they'll say, yep, sure enough, maybe he made up his mind before then, or he was thinking about it, and he lied. We'll see. And he says, what you have to understand is the frames that the Republicans are using for this war. Because when somebody views this war, this occupation, we shouldn't even call it a war, we should call it an occupation. When somebody views the occupation of Iraq through one of these GOP frames, it doesn't matter whether we lied to get into it or not. Because if they believe the frame, then maybe even the lie was a noble lie. I mean, there is the idea of a noble lie, right? There's some people, I mean, everybody tells a noble lie once in a while. Yes, you look beautiful in that dress. Come on, we've all done that. And so the GOP is, you know, this will be their fallback. So what are the primary frames that the GOP is using to frame this war? Well, the first, according to Jeffrey Feldman, is the empire strikes first. We're actually using the word empire now to describe the United States. And it's the whole idea that if we don't stand tall, if we don't get out there, if we don't create an imperial force and get out there in the world and strike first, if we don't expand outward and take strong control of the world, then our interests are not served. It's the reason why the British believed in imperialism. It's why the Spanish supported the Spanish Empire. It's why, you know, this is a frame that people will buy into quite easily. The Romans were quite proud of their Roman Empire. And, you know, the Trojans and the Athenians, and I mean, it's on and on it goes, right? So the empire strikes first. We are going to, in order to be safe and secure, we must become the, capital T-H-E, the world power. And the first step to that is to establish a presence in the Middle East. This is the frame that the Project for a New American Century laid out in 1998. That's the first frame that the GOP is using. Now, in the context of that big frame, there are, you know, these three or smaller frames. The first one, again, in the context of the idea that we have to control the world, the first one is war in Iraq means safety at home, says Jeffrey Feldman at frameshopisopen.com. War in Iraq means safety at home. And it's surprising the number of people who actually believe this. They, you know, I have had, you know, conservatives call this program and say, hey, I'd rather have us fighting them in the streets of Baghdad than in the streets of New York. And my response is, I didn't realize those were the only two choices. I thought the third choice was we could just not fight them because they're not going to come after us. Because we've worked things out. Because if you look back, Osama bin Laden back in 1996 said that he was going to come after us if we didn't pull our troops out of Saudi Arabia. That we were committing blasphemy because he had bought into Wahhabism. He was one of those Wahhabists. You know, remember the deal with the devil that was made? By the Saudi, by King Fahd, the Saudi royal family, back 50 years ago. Yes, we'll let the fundamentalists participate. We'll give money to the fundamentalists and we'll support them if they support us in power. That was the deal that the Saudis made with the Wahhabists. And so bin Laden, a good Wahhabist, a good Sunni Wahhabist, he said to us, if you don't stop pumping cheap oil out of Saudi Arabia. He thought the price of oil should be $200 a barrel. And he said anything less than that, and we're robbing his country of its natural resources, number one. And we were propping up a corrupt government in order to get cheap oil. And there's an element of truth to it. And number two, he said, if you don't get your American soldiers off our land, who were put there by George Bush Sr. During the Gulf War, he said, if you don't get your soldiers off our property, because you've got men who are drinking alcohol and women who are driving and not veiled, and that's a blasphemy. Saudi Arabia is a holy land in Islam, and you're committing blasphemy on holy land. If you don't do that, I'm going to come after you, said Osama bin Laden. It was published in the New York Times, and sure enough, he came after us over and over and over and over again. Finally got us in a big way. But now George Bush, wisely I might add, and I don't say that very often about George Bush, maybe it was Colin Powell's decision. George Bush has pulled us out of Saudi Arabia. We've taken our troops out of Saudi Arabia. And so, you know, I don't see these guys coming after us anymore. Or as much, let's say. Now they're coming after us because we went into Iraq. But anyhow, the argument that somehow by creating a war in downtown Baghdad, we're making downtown New York safer is nuts. But it's a frame that people believe. War in Iraq means safety at home. Another frame that the Republicans are using, another subframe to this empire frame, is America must spread freedom in the world. This also part of the project for New American Century. The question asked, should America just sit still while some other power takes control of the world? This is what the PNAC said. And, you know, the problem is the Democrats have no response to this. Sure, America should spread freedom in the world. You know, I think America should, because America should spread freedom in the world. I just don't think that we should do it at the end of the barrel of a gun. I don't think that works. I think we should do it by being an example of freedom in the world. By being a good neighbor. As Jack Kennedy said. But the Democratic Party has not, you know, they don't have a frame of their own to respond to this. Just like the Democratic Party does not have a frame to respond to, you know, war, you know, if war in Iraq means safety at home. That, you know, if we don't kill them in Baghdad, they're going to come to get us in Detroit. And the third subframe is that you're a good American if you served in the armed forces, if you're serving in the armed forces. And Feldman suggests this is the most vulnerable to the GOP and the most and yet the most overlooked by Democrats. He says Democrats, for their part, have wielded phrases like support the troops, but have not made any attempt to claim the service to country frame on Iraq. And the only way that progressives or the Democratic Party in particular are going to succeed in responding to these frames that the GOP have very, very wisely put out is to come up with their own frames. And I'm telling you, the Downing Street memo proves that George Bush lied is not a frame. Bush lied and American soldiers died. That's the beginning of one. But Downing Street proves he lied to us. I'm telling you, people will say, okay, next. We're already there. We got to keep fighting them because if we don't, then they'll be here in Detroit or Portland or you know, Santa Fe, New Mexico. They're gonna come and get us. And, we've got to support our patriotic soldiers. And we've got to spread freedom around the world. So even if George lied, you know, there's going to be some kind of good. I heard Chris Matthews say this last night. Even if Bush lied us into this war, there's some good outcome going to come out of it if we can just get it right. The Democrats have to respond to this. And Feldman suggests a frame. He says, the great myth of the neocon movement perpetrated by people like Newt Gingrich and Paul Wolfowitz is that American safety depends on America standing alone in the world and striking first at anyone who may threaten us in the future. This could not be further from reality. In fact, the world has been and will be safest only when the great diversity of sovereign nations is able to unify and work together. So this is the progressive reframe that Jeff Feldman over at FrameShopIsOpen.com suggests. The progressive reframe. Democrats, listen carefully. Number one, Americans serve our military when the cause is just and true. In other words, the reason why people are not signing up is because we are not involved in a war that has a just and true cause. When you have a just and true cause, you have people like my father who volunteered to fight in World War II. They don't have to be drafted. They show up on their own. When Washington stops lying, starts telling the public the truth about what we're up to in Iraq and how to and what our real goals are, instead of, oh, it's to spread freedom, it's to stop the terrorists before they get to us. I'm sorry. It doesn't wash. Let's talk about oil. Let's talk about domination of the Middle East. You know, when they start telling the truth to us and to the Iraqi people, then your enlistment numbers are going to go back up. Another frame, the smart military is a strong military. The White House has made lousy decisions that have divided the world. Let's point this out. They've weakened our armed forces. They've turned American citizens against each other. The Bush House dove into Iraq without a smart plan, leaving America unguarded, with untrusting allies and severely vulnerable at home. Our military is strongest and our country is safest, writes Feldman, when we make smart military decisions that unify our citizens and strengthen our relationships to our allies. And Bush is doing the exact opposite. And number three, America has a duty not so much to spread freedom around the world, but to promote independence and unity in the world, because that will lead to freedom. Rather than building up a force capable of defending Americans at home, the Bush administration has become obsessed with closing bases in order to create a new mega military capable of fighting multiple wars abroad. This is wrong. America must be a leader in global diplomacy. We need a diplomat in the UN, not somebody like John Bolton who's going to go in and, you know, like a bull in a china shop and try and blow the top 10 floors off the UN building. So the Democrats need to come up with some new frames. We need progressive frames for this. And we also need to be framing the Downing Street memo in a context that's larger than simply George Bush lied to us, or maybe we should impeach him. I mean, keep in mind, even the Republicans, when it was Bill Clinton lied, the frame really wasn't Bill Clinton lied, therefore let's impeach him. The frame really was Bill Clinton's lie proves that he is so immoral that he is not capable of being a good president and that he can't offer moral leadership and therefore lead the country. That was the Republican frame. And that stuck way beyond the did he lie or didn't he lie. And it's a similar frame has to be applied to George W. Bush. 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by.
And welcome back, my friends.
I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you.
Welcome back. So glad to have you back with the program. 1-866-889-8894 is the toll-free number for the Tom Hartman program. And Roy in New Mexico on the line. Hey, Roy, what's up?
Oh, good afternoon, Tom. I wanted to mention the energy bill that's coming up. Domenici and Bingaman were on C-SPAN this morning and talking about how they negotiated. And Bingaman saying, well, gee, it's not perfect, but it's the best we can do, yada, yada, yada. And a caller called in and asked about, well, how come in this bill there's the provisions for a bunch of Enron execs to get guaranteed loans, and neither one of them knew what he was talking about, and both of them denied it. That just wouldn't happen.
That's incredible.
And so I wrote them both a letter and faxed it off, and one of them. But the thing is that this stuff gets buried in there. I want to just, you know, as folks hear and see nonsense like that, I've already got a call in to the managing editor at the Journal, and I zapped off an email to him, and then I faxed him a letter and said, hey, how come your staff didn't know this? Why? Not only did you deny it, you lied to the public by saying it couldn't possibly be in there.
Right, right. Yeah,
and
this is...
It just gets all, you know, we're chunking down here, but...
Yeah, no, it is so important that we be holding them accountable, right? I absolutely agree with you.
There is so many specifics, and your rant with the generals, what the general said, my nephew, which was a Lance Corporal, 3 months over there last year. He could have told them that while
he was saying the same
in
thing.
The hospital.
Yep.
The kid that was out here signing up voters with us, he could have told them that when his squad took 60% casualties over there protecting the borders from Syria or whatever. Yeah. I mean, this isn't brain surgery or rocket science. These people are lying to us.
Yeah.
They're lying to us, and that's immoral.
And I think to some extent they're lying to themselves as well. I think there are really people who believe their own PR in this. And, you know, they've put out this frame, and some of them have really bought into it. And that's a tragedy as well. We need to be waking up, you know, conservatives as well as progressives. Roy, thanks a lot for the call. It's always great to hear from you. I do appreciate it. Wrapping up another day here, your daily minimum daily requirement of sanity on the Tom Hartman program, the place where being progressive never felt so good. Thanks to our listeners. Thanks to you for listening to us. Thanks to Scott for coming in and answering phones, engineering the program today, to Louise for producing it, to the folks at White Rose Society, RadioPower.org, American FM for streaming us. and the folks at CRN Digital for getting us out there. And thanks to the radio stations for carrying us. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.